For many aspects of healthcare, quality isn't measurable at scale, and high performance isn't necessarily rewarded. Nonetheless, patients, and society as a whole, depend on clinicians and the organizations employing them to provide high-quality services in those areas. I'm Stephen Morrissey, Managing Editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Lawrence Casalino, a professor of population health sciences at Weill Cornell Medicine. Dr. Casalino has written a perspective article about corporatization, professionalism, and quality of care as part of the journal series on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare. Dr. Casalino, in your perspective article, you refer to key areas of quality that aren't measured and probably couldn't be measured. What are some examples of those areas of healthcare?
I'll give two examples. I will say that I think that there's more, most clinicians would agree with this, I suspect, that there is much more that isn't measured than is measured. So, two examples. One is just in general, timely and accurate diagnosis. I think that that's very important to patients, actually, to have timely and accurate diagnosis of their symptoms. And physicians really respect other physicians who are good diagnosticians. It's hard to imagine that the accuracy and timeliness of diagnosis will ever be measurable at scale. And in fact, there's danger that things that are being measured could take some time and energy away from physicians trying to make a good diagnosis quickly. I'll give an actual true story to illustrate this. I'm not trying to brag. This story is about me, but it's the kind of thing that clinicians do all day long. But I do want to illustrate the importance of unmeasured quality. So I was a primary care physician. It was middle of the afternoon. As usual, by the middle of the afternoon, I was quite far behind because I pretty routinely took more time with patients than their appointments were booked for. So I was behind, and I saw on the schedule that my next patient was a new patient, a middle-aged man with headaches. I knew his wife quite well, and she was actually a pretty difficult patient. She always came in with lots of minor complaints. I always spent a lot more time with her than allotted by the appointment schedule, and she often left apparently not satisfied, although she kept coming to see me, and her husband then came to see me. Anyway, I worried a little bit about what this was going to do to me staying on schedule. I knew the next patient after him was a kind of hard-charging attorney. And at this time, we had sold our practice to a major academic medical center. They were measuring patient satisfaction, and part of our pay depended on that. So I didn't want to make the attorney unhappy. In any case, long story short, the patient with the headache was totally reasonable. We had a good discussion. We spent about 25 minutes for a 15-minute appointment. As I was leaving, the headaches didn't seem to be anything very important. I had my hand on the doorknob to leave the room, and he said, "Hey, Doc, how come when I walk sometimes, I just get kind of tired now? No chest pain, no really typical cardiac symptoms. He just kind of got tired walking." He was about 50 years old. I think some days I probably would have just laughed and said, "Well, we're not getting any younger," and kept going out the door. This time I came back in, sat down, talked to him a little bit. And after talking to him, although he never had any pain, I was pretty sure he had coronary artery disease. Called the cardiologist, got him right in. Next week, he had surgery for triple vessel disease, which is quite serious and can result in sudden death. So that was high quality. If anything looked like lower quality in terms of patient experience measures, in terms of the attorney waiting still longer for me to get to see him. But that was good. So that's an example, Stephen. It's easy to give many more. Every doctor could do that.
Why is professionalism, including intrinsic motivation, especially relevant in those areas?
So professionalism, the core tenet of professionalism is one puts the patient first, right? That physicians are supposed to have intrinsic motivation to do what's best for the patient regardless. So society really depends on professionalism to get good care in the areas that aren't measured. Actually, Kenneth Arrow, who was a Nobel Prize-winning economist, wrote about this in the 60s and said patients don't expect physicians to have the ethics of a shoe salesman, not to criticize shoe salesmen, but they may be trying to sell you some shoes that you may or may not need. You don't necessarily want your physicians to be like that. So I think that to get good quality in the areas that aren't measured and probably never will be measured, we do depend on physician professionalism. Now, I don't think physician professionalism is some kind of static metaphysical entity that all physicians have to the max. Physicians, again, I think most clinicians would agree with this, vary tremendously on how intrinsically motivated they are and how professionally they act. And I think that this can change over time too in individual physicians. There are probably factors, which we could talk about if you like, that make physicians probably more or less likely to act professionally.
So you say in your article that corporate organizations may be less likely than other organizations to support this intrinsic motivation of physicians. So what evidence is there on the effects of corporate ownership on professionalism?
I don't think there are any direct studies. First of all, physician professionalism is hard to measure. So there aren't really any studies that show that large corporations, for example, or private equity firms, or we could take various examples, affect physician professionalism. I think it, to some extent, it's common sense that the larger an organization is and the stronger its short-term financial incentives to show profits, the more it will treat people, not just physicians, but other staff as widgets that can, interchangeable widgets whose behavior can be monitored and controlled, measured and rewarded or penalized in order to maximize profits.
In your article, you cite several other factors that could support or undermine physician professionalism, including leadership, size, which you've mentioned, and culture. As for leadership, what's known about how the leadership structure of an organization affects its quality?
Again, there's a whole literature on this in the social sciences, different kinds of leadership, and for that matter, different kinds of organizational culture. And it doesn't look like there's one size, one type of leadership that's best or one type of organizational culture that is best. But I think that there is some evidence in healthcare that organizations in which the leadership is respected by physicians and includes physicians who are seen by their peers as actual physicians, not someone who got an MDA and then an MBA and really never practiced. I think that many of the most respected organizations in the country that deliver healthcare have that kind of leadership, so kind of co-leadership by physician and non-physician executives. Kaiser would be an example. Kaiser, typically, physicians come up through the ranks. They're seen by their fellow physicians as peers, and they trust them more than they would trust, say, a practice is owned by a private equity firm. I think they would trust Dr. So-and-so, who's been a practicing physician in the organization for decades, and who many of the physicians know and respect, probably trust that physician more than they would trust the person who's put in the position of leadership for the medical group by the private equity team that owns the group.
You say in your article that many current policies aren't based on evidence and tend intentionally or inadvertently to reward corporatization. So what policies have had the greatest influence on the trend toward increased corporatization in healthcare?
Wow. So there's quite a list. I think that with some exceptions, there's been a failure of federal and state antitrust enforcement. To some extent, for horizontal integration, like hospitals acquiring other hospitals, but also vertical, such as hospitals acquiring medical groups. So antitrust is one. There's also a failure of antitrust in looking at health insurer mergers. And by the way, in the U.S. hospital markets, about 70% now are highly concentrated, where one or two hospitals are really dominant. And this does for sure lead to higher prices with uncertain effects on quality. So antitrust is one. A lot of states have corporate practice of medicine laws that are supposed to prevent corporate ownership of medical practices and corporate possibly interference in the practice of medicine. Those laws are not very well enforced. There are about $80 billion a year in overpayments from Medicare to Medicare Advantage health insurers. Congress has been looking at this recently quite a bit. This $80 billion, obviously, it's not all used this way, but it can be used for health insurers to buy medical groups. And the prime example is United Healthcare, which employs a lot of physicians and a few years ago bought one of the biggest medical groups in the United States, Healthcare Partners, and now manages physicians through its Optum division. There's a variety of policies here. As you can see, I can go on. There are gag clauses which prevent, if you're a physician, for example, that works in a practice that's been acquired by a private equity firm, there's usually gag clauses that make it very risky for you to speak out publicly if you think anything is going on in the organization that might jeopardize patient care. There's a lack of ownership transparency. It's very difficult for anybody. I mean, I can go online for such and such a medical group and try to figure out who owns the group. Very, very difficult, even for someone who kind of knows what to look for, to figure out who owns what. If you're a patient, it's kind of hopeless. So 27 states now actually have bills in their legislatures looking to provide more ownership transparency and in other ways regulate private equity and more generally corporate ownership of medical care. I could go on, but that's an example. There are others. These are policies that are not necessarily bad policies. Some of them clearly are, but they have the unintended effect sometimes of encouraging consolidation, excessive size, and corporatization. I'll give one example to be more specific. There's the 340B drug pricing program, where certain hospitals are permitted by Medicare. They're able to get drugs, usually expensive injectable drugs, at a relatively low price. And this is particularly in oncology and ophthalmology, for example, rheumatology to some extent as well. They can buy the drugs at the low price, but they can get paid for injecting these drugs at the market price. And so that is quite profitable and makes it possible for these groups that extra profit that they can get compared to a medical group that has to buy the drugs and inject them. they can use that profit to basically buy ophthalmology and oncology practice, and particularly in oncology, that's very common. That's a well-intentioned program because the idea was to let basically safety net hospitals that don't have a lot of money, this would be a way for them to get some revenue. But the program has expanded so that most hospitals are now part of it, including hospitals that by no means could be considered financially stressed. That's a long answer, but there are other examples of well-intentioned policies that in practice encourage corporatization and consolidation.
So finally, I want to ask about changes that could benefit patients by supporting professionalism. And I mean, you might say that it's just a matter of reversing the policies that you've just talked about, but what would be possible and where should we start?
So I would distinguish private policies and public policies. Private policies are what the policies that organizations make themselves. So hospital system, for example, for its hospitals and physicians. And I would say that to the extent that there can be joint leadership between physicians and non-physician executives, that greatly increases the chance that physicians are going to be in an organization that encourages them to act professionally. So that's an example of a private policy. Public policies, I think many fronts, you're right, as you say, reversing or at least changing the incentives and regulation in the areas I mentioned. So antitrust, corporate practice, medicine, overpayments to Medicare Advantage plans, and that's $80 billion a year. Like that money could be used for a lot of other things. There's the 340B drug pricing program I mentioned, GAG closes, ownership transparency, and the lots of suggestions for ways to try to regulate private equity, which has very, very strong incentives to generate short-term profits that may not be best suited for patients. I want to emphasize that there are people who believe that we live in a capitalist economy and competition is good and will increase quality and efficiency. And competition is good, but it's hard to get good competition in medical care for a lot of reasons. One is that you can't really measure most quality that well. So organizations can make a lot more money by getting bigger and bigger so that they have more negotiating leverage with the other guys. So health insurers can get bigger so they can have more negotiating leverage with hospitals and physician groups. Hospital systems can get bigger so they have more negotiating leverage with health insurers. Patients see this all the time when they don't know if their doctor and hospital are still going to be in the health insurance plan that they're in, for example, United Healthcare, or not. So I think there have to be multiple fronts. Antitrust enforcement was something that could do a lot.
Thank you, Dr. Castellino.